This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
What a difference a year makes, especially when it comes to Michigan's apple harvest. And with us is Dr. Randy Beaudry, a Michigan State University horticulturalist and MSU Ag Bio Research Scientist. And Randy's going to share what is some of the very, very good news for the Michigan apple industry for those of us who love apples. Randy, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you, Kirk. Nice to be here.
Well, last year was a tough year for the apple industry. This year, at least in terms of the harvest, what a difference.
Oh my gosh, yeah. It's hard to imagine the difference between these 2 years. So last year, we had one of the lowest crops on record, 10% of a normal crop. This year, we have the largest crop ever.
And it all has to do with weather conditions, I presume.
That's exactly right, yeah. So 2012 was one of the warmest seasons on record. So it got warm early, but the frosts didn't go away. So we had an early a frost at a normal time of the year. But by that time, the fruit trees had already started to produce blooms. And so one of those frosts caught the blooms at a tender stage, and we lost the crop.
Now, obviously, growers had some economic reverberations from last year's crop. Are they going to be able to recoup those losses with a bumper crop this year?
Well, I sure hope so. It's a complicated situation, as you might guess. Last year, when we didn't have a crop, that was actually a good time in some ways for our grower/storage community to sort of regroup. So there were some groups on the ridge, the fruit area, growing area of Michigan, and they decided at that point in time that they would be building storage capacity. Because with every off year, it follows with a year of boom, I guess I would say. So this particular year, yeah, we have a very, very large crop. And for what it's worth, it's one of the finest looking crops that anybody I know or anyone I have talked to has ever seen hanging on Michigan fruit trees.
Well, this could be a double-edged sword, and you've been working with the Michigan apple industry for a long time, Randy, but you have that kind of supply going out onto the marketplace. That can have a depressing effect on price.
That's exactly right, yeah. So there are a few forces, as I alluded to, that might make this, even though it's a boom year, it might make this a bit of a tight or a tough year to get through. So one of those is price. Yeah, with a large crop coming on, we're going to have a downward pressure on price. The marketers all understand that last year there was no money coming in, and so they're going to try to maintain that price as much as they possibly can. But, of course, the large box stores know the story, too, and they know there's a lot of fruit that have to be moved. All of these fruit, they're fresh, and they're living, and they have a limited lifespan, and so they have to be marketed. So there's no question about hanging on to them forever. So there's always a pressure to get them through the marketplace, and so it kind of puts us in a bind between, you know, trying to maintain the life and the quality of those fruit at the same time marketing them in a reasonable time frame to get a good price on those fruit. Yeah.
But what may be a difficult problem for producers and shippers and processors, et cetera, might be really good news for consumers like myself who, for example, really love those Honeycrisp apples.
Absolutely, yeah. You're going to see a lot of apples in the marketplace. Actually, they're already running into the marketplace at a very high clip. And we're seeing, like I said, good quality, and probably there'll be a slight improvement in price, I guess, with regard to the consumers. That doesn't always bode well for the growers. So if you think about it from a grower's perspective, they're producing a very large crop. They have all of the normal expenses associated with growing that crop. And then if they have a slightly downward pressure on price, then it cuts their margins. So you have a large crop but a thin margin, and it makes for a pretty dicey situation if anything goes wrong. And by something going wrong, I mean like a spate of bad weather. So if, for instance, they had a week of rain and they couldn't get out into the fields, oh my gosh, then those fruit continue to ripen and continue to develop. And if they get out of condition too far, then they won't store, and then we're losing fruit, basically. So you can see where the risk factor comes in.
Absolutely. My guest is Dr. Randy Beaudry, who's an MSU horticulturalist specialist in apple research. Let's talk a little bit about some of the research you've been doing for a long time, and that's a way of keeping some of these apples off the marketplace during harvest, so you avoid the glut that you mentioned before, and that's controlled atmosphere storage. Tell us a little bit, what is controlled atmosphere storage, and how does that work to the benefit of the producer?
Yeah, controlled atmosphere storage is kind of as it's described. It's a way of manipulating or managing the atmosphere around the fruit. They are rooms where you modify the oxygen and carbon dioxide inside the room, and there you'll find these rooms scattered across the Fruit Ridge area, the Belding area, and other places around Michigan. And they're very large rooms in which you store a large number of fruit, close the doors, seal up the room. It's an airtight room, and then slowly bring down the oxygen and then elevate the carbon dioxide. The low oxygen inhibits ripening, and carbon dioxide tends to do a little bit of the same. So if you reach kind of a magic proportion between the two, you can keep the fruit from ripening and advancing in their development for months at a stretch.
I've always thought of it in terms of, for lack of a better word, suspended animation for the fruit, where because what you're doing has no long-term impact on quality or crispness or any of the qualities of the apple. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting physiological sort of thing, but that's exactly right. Yeah, apples, like every organism out there, has kind of a developmental progression that they're involved in. And this last step in the progression or the development of apple fruit involves this hormone called ethylene. And it's a natural hormone that the plants produce, and it causes ripening. Well, if we reduce oxygen and elevate the CO2 a little bit, yeah, it shuts down the ability of the fruit to perceive that ethylene. So they kind of get locked at this stage just before ripening, and we can hold them at that stage of development for months at a time. And in fact, we have some new chemistries out there, some very interesting, very benign compounds that are almost like magic in a way. They specifically bind to the site that causes ethylene reactions to occur and ethylene responses to occur, and stops them from progressing. So in combination with the low oxygen and the CO2, this material, which is called 1-methylcyclopropene, stops ripening. And we can keep fruit, not that we always want to, but we could keep them a year, maybe a year and a half, if we absolutely had to. But of course, in the industry, you don't want to do that because you are incurring expenses the whole time.
Mm-hmm,
and really, after about 8 or 9 months, you're starting to have some quality losses associated with that, some moisture loss, loss of that nice acidity, the sort of sour note that some people like in their apple fruit, that kind of thing.
But from a 6 to 8 month period, there's really, from the consumer standpoint, no really noticeable loss of flavor.
Not really, no. No, I accidentally left some Empire apples in my storages this last year, and I pulled them out a month ago. So they were in storage for 11 months, and they came out like diamonds. They were great.
And by the way, Empires are one of my favorites as well. I've mentioned Honeycrisp, but those Empires are great. And a lot of Empires are grown in Michigan.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it was one of those varieties that was kind of on the border of being lost from, I guess, our portfolio of apples here in Michigan. But with the apple slice market that's increased here in Michigan, it'll come to the fore, I guess I would say, in terms of production, it saved the Honeycrisp apple, which is a very nice, crunchy, lovely piece of fruit. Yeah, pretty too.
Yeah, it's lovely. Another issue, though, we talked about the good and the bad of this apple boom, but you got to have people to harvest these apples. And we both know about the labor issues in agriculture as something that the Congress is trying to deal with. But some of these growers have a hard time getting their fruit off the trees, don't they, Randy?
That's exactly right, yeah. So let's suppose that you've got the largest crop that you've ever had, right, which would, in a normal year, be difficult to get harvested at the appropriate stage, put into storage, put to sleep, so to speak, and so that we have, you know, so the consumer has apple fruit throughout the year. And now, if you put on top of that the added pressure of a low labor pool or a minimal labor pool, yeah, that makes it very, very difficult for the growers to do their job and the storage operators to successfully store those fruit. So I'm quite concerned for our apple industry this year. We have been blessed this year, actually, with very, very good weather. Up to this point, anyway. We're looking at a couple of days rain, and when it rains, they don't tend to harvest, so it's not safe to be in the orchard climbing ladders and things like that in the rain. So if we get too extended a period of rain, we will find ourselves really in a tight situation. But so far, as I understand it, many of our growers have been able to sort of keep pace. They're falling back a little bit, but they're sort of keeping up with it, with the good weather we've had.
And I know you're a horticulturalist, and we're getting to economic issues here, but the importance of the apple industry to Michigan's economy really can't be understated.
That's exactly right. It's worth millions, tens of millions of dollars to our state. And then there are knock-on effects, you know, all of those rural communities that are supported by the apple industry as well. So it is a complicated equation, I'm sure, but we don't need to lose an industry here in this state due to problems associated with labor or weather or, you know, other poor, I would say, other ill-timed,
difficult issues. But as we're grappling with those issues, Randy, certainly consumers can enjoy a bountiful harvest and some wonderful apples, whether they're fresh market or processed, in those apple pies.
That's exactly right, yeah. Yeah, I think we're going to be looking at a year where people will remark about the quality and the flavor of the apple fruits, not to mention their appearance. I mean, I've never seen fruit trees that look half green, half red in my life. And this year, we see that as we drive up around the Fruit Ridge area. So I'm kind of hopeful that we're going to see the consumers really appreciate these fruit and be able to enjoy them for an extended period.
And look for Michigan apples, buy Michigan, go to those farm markets, wherever you go, wherever you shop, look for Michigan apples, right?
I think that's a great idea. Yeah, we should all be doing that.
My guest has been Randy Beaudry. He is a horticulturalist at Michigan State University. He's also, his research is supported in part by MSU Ag Bio Research. Randy, thanks so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me, Kirk.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. Making a Michigan State University education accessible to all is a key pillar of President Simon's Boulder by Design initiative. And that's why MSU Alumni Association chapters around the world raise hundreds of thousands of dollars in scholarship money each year. Our members share our belief that the same educational experiences we enjoyed should be available to future generations of Spartans. That's why we support MSU's innovative Grandparents University, where you and your grandchild can learn from some of Michigan State's most gifted professors. It's why we touch thousands of lives each year with our career enrichment seminars. And it's why MSU Alumni Association chapters are among the first to welcome new students at dozens of annual freshman family picnics in every city from Detroit to D.C. The MSU Alumni Association was founded to add Spartan value throughout your Spartan life. If you share this Spartan spirit, join us at alumni.msu.edu.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, Michigan State's Munn Ice Arena has had a major makeover, including some new lights. Lights that will enhance both fan and player experience and save MSU a lot of money. Here to tell us about it is Greg Iani, who is the Deputy Director of MSU Athletics. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kirk.
Tell us about these new lights at Munn.
It's part of our major renovation that we're doing right now. The first phase is replacing the ice plant in the building. And as part of our examination of how we could maybe save some money, cut our energy costs, the lighting factor was reviewed. And the current lights we have, first of all, are very energy inefficient. Two, they produce a lot of heat. So anybody out there who knows anything about, you know, ice and heat and ice are a bad combination.
Bad combo.
So we investigated the possibility of a new lighting system using LED lights. So we contacted our friends at Musco, who are the leaders in sports lighting, and they're the ones that provide the temporary lights at all these venues for football. They've been providing the lights at Spartan Stadium for years. They've done other lighting projects on campus, including the IM East fields and our practice football fields at Duffy. So we brought them in and said, you know, what do you think? Well, they weren't quite ready to release, or they were getting close to releasing this new fixture. And I said, well, how about putting it in Michigan State first place? And they said, well, let's see if we can get it done fast enough. So one thing led to another, and we developed this really a partnership with Musco. And they made it cost effective for us on the front end. The university, and I have to really compliment Linda Boomer out of our IPF services here on campus. And Linda has been in charge of energy savings and the greening of campus, if you will, for a number of years, very aggressively. And she helped us find funding to do this. And lo and behold, we've got the lights, and what a difference.
Correct. Now, I understand not only the energy savings and the heat factor you already mentioned, Greg, but apparently it enhances the fan experience because they can see, it's like high-definition television or something?
It is. Yeah. You can sit up in the stands now and you can, I mean, the faces of the athletes are very vivid and the colors are very vivid. It's funny, when we did the test, they lit half the arena with LED and left the others, our current install, our old install in the building, and the difference was phenomenal. I saw things in that building I hadn't seen before, and didn't really want to see some of the stuff, but it made a marked difference. And I think the average spectator who goes in there is really gonna enjoy the difference. The athletes really enjoy it. The goalies are seeing the puck better. It's just better for the student athletes and their participation factor and how they play the game. And then there's been a kind of a carryover effect on this, because as we've been designing this new ice making refrigeration plant that we're going to put in here in the spring, that the board has already approved and we're moving forward with, it's a domino effect in that if we have less light, less heat, I should say, on the ice from the lights, we don't have to generate use as much energy to create ice. So it's saving us money, one, in what it costs to make ice. It saved us money in that we didn't have to purchase the equipment that would use as much energy as it would have if we had the old lighting system. So it's just been this positive domino effect in that we've been able to save energy costs, save on initial installation. It's really been a win-win across the board.
My guest is Greg Iani, who's the Deputy Director of MSU Athletics. Greg, you mentioned that the goalies can see the pucks better, and that could end up being fewer goals per game down the trail if the goalie. But that notwithstanding, the return on investment is pretty amazing. I mean, you're going to be able to pay for these lights in terms of energy savings over how long a period of time, essentially?
Between 5 and 7 years.
5 and 7 years.
Depending on how much we use the lights, which is an incredible number, because the payback, of course, that's the first thing Linda looked at. What's the payback? And the payback was so extraordinary that it really was a no-brainer to do it, you know, a no-brainer decision. So, again, it's kind of fun to be involved in projects where we're becoming not only energy consumers, but good stewards of the energy that we use, and being part of the university's mission and the greening of the campus.
Yeah, you talked about Be Spartan Green. You talked about the energy transition plan. You're involved in virtually everything that's going on construction-wise with athletics. Are there some other initiatives that are underway that speak to the greening of the campus?
Well, yeah, we've got the North End Zone project that's going on right now at the stadium. And the fact that we're using LED technology in that building, that all the equipment that we're using, the air handling equipment, all those things that are energy intensive to operate, are state of the art. So the things that we're doing now are in concert with what the university policies are now. And so, when you walk in a room, we've got the automatic technology that turns the lights on and off, the occupancy lightings, those kinds of little things that the university has added to all of their building codes that now we get a chance to take advantage of as we build a new facility. So really what we're doing is we're getting a very old facility that was outdated and getting a positive plus for us to get this new facility, but we're also taking the opportunity to get in lockstep with where the university wants to go and what President Simon wants to do with how we consume energy on this campus.
Well, you mentioned the End Zone project, and we've talked about Munn. Anything in the works for Breslin?
You know, we're the Breslin lighting system has been something that we've looked at. Again, Breslin's not an athletic facility, and
that's right. I have to be reminded.
It's run by it's managed by Vinnie Gore's operation in the housing area, and but we've looked at a number of things. The lights in Breslin are it's an older technology. We have to relamp that system every year. It's about a $10,000-$11,000 cost that we split between athletics and Vinny's operation on relamping those lights. So there's that cost. They're very energy inefficient because it's an older technology. And from a marketing event standpoint, we've always wanted to be able to turn those lights off, do spotlight introductions, do different things in the game that creates more energy, more excitement. We haven't been able to do that because there's a 20-minute relamp time, relighting time, if you will, on those lights. So staff from Breslin wanted to see, and the folks wanted to see how it looked in Munn. That's been an overwhelmingly positive response. Two other major universities have installed LED lighting in their basketball venues, Arizona State and Notre Dame. So we're going to go down and take a look at the Notre Dame lighting setup. But I think there's a good chance that the university is going to take a look at a similar system in Breslin that we have in Munn. And if we get there, the energy savings there will be tremendous because of the amount of energy that older system burns now. So,
you know, Greg, this is a little off the subject of facilities, but I think it's an interesting question to raise. You're around the coaches and the athletes all the time by virtue of your position. This energy efficiency, the green initiatives going on campus, all of the things that Michigan State's trying to do, do you see that enthusiasm filtering down among the students and the coaches as well?
You know, there's an awareness, I think, that I haven't seen before, that from, you know, not only from our student-athletes, from our entire staff, but I think the important thing is you almost have to make energy consumption and savings of energy something that people don't have to think about. So that's why I like, if you can build things into your buildings, build things into your systems that manage those things that are really human-proof, if you will, because we all walk out of room. We do this at home. We walk out of rooms and don't turn lights off, right, or we don't, you know, just things like that because we've got other things on our mind. So to put systems in, and we did this in Scandalaris. All the lights in Scandalaris are this way. They're room occupancy lights. So you walk in, the light comes on, you walk out, they go off. And so if it becomes second nature and things just happen, if you can build those things into your facilities, it makes it a whole lot easier, I think, on everybody. And we've done that with our newer buildings. And the fact that the university now, in their codes and in their building codes, has specified those things, you almost want it to be something you don't have to think about, but somebody's been thinking about it.
Yeah, and then we get the message out about how much money that's saving the taxpayers, how much that's saving the university, the athletic department, then it really becomes a win-win story.
Yeah, no question, no question. And you know, in the situation we're in now, Kirk, with finances in the state and our own personal finances, you know, we have to be good stewards of the dollars that the good people of the state of Michigan give Michigan State University to run this great university. So, you know, it's incumbent upon us to look at those things. We have to do those things to keep our credibility with the people of the state, with the lawmakers who determine who gets the money. I think that's really important. And it's going to become even more important as future generations move through this institution.
Absolutely. Well, I've been talking with Greg Iani about some of the green initiatives in MSU Athletics. He is the Deputy Director of MSU Athletics. Greg, thanks so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Kirk, thank you. Appreciate it.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Please find us on Facebook by searching for Greening of the Great Lakes and follow us on Twitter at Green Michigan.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. How many times have you been wearing your Spartan apparel in an airport and a voice in the crowd shouts, "Go Green"? Well, that's happened to me in Beijing, Osaka, Kuala Lumpur, and Mumbai, and even in unlikely places like Ann Arbor and Columbus. There's a special bond we Spartans share, and that's at the foundation of everything we do at the MSU Alumni Association. As the world's largest organization of Spartans helping Spartans, MSUAA truly is your personal network for life.
From the moment you join, you've added thousands of fellow Spartans to your personal network. People who will pick up the phone and lend a hand just because you share Michigan State in common. That's the ethic that makes Spartans leaders, lifesavers, and world changers. And that's exactly what you'll find when you become an active member of the MSU Alumni Association. If you share this Spartan spirit, join us at alumni.msu.edu.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, there's been a lot of chatter around the state about our deposit law and perhaps it being modified or changed. And a lot of that might be valid information. A lot of it might be misinformation. But to get the scoop, the straight scoop on what's going on, we welcome back good friend Tom Emmerich. Tom is president of Shupan Recycling, which is a division of Shupan & Sons. Shupan Recycling is Michigan's largest recycler of used beverage containers, aluminum, plastic, and glass. Tom, always great to see you.
Thank you very much for having me back. Glad being here.
There's a lot in the news about Michigan's deposit law. There's legislation pending to modify that. Some people are saying, let's get rid of it. What's going on, Tom?
What happened was back in November of last year, the governor had a speech where he mentioned the low recycling rate in the state of Michigan for municipal solid waste. And he would like to see that increase, which I think we all would. He then put in charge of that effort to understand the issue. The DEQ director, Dan Wyant, put together a team, and they've done a very nice job trying to investigate and see where is Michigan really stand and what options are available to us. So that's kind of what got the ball rolling in discussion. And out of all that, the DEQ came up with a six-point plan of recommendations, which some are a bit controversial. The thing that I find kind of interesting is that the deposit law seems to be the one that jumps off the page, because there's one comment about the deposit law looking at it and see if there's ways to improve it and change it. But there's five other items on the DEQ's list
that are not particularly controversial. Recycling education and things of that nature,
correct.
We can all agree with.
Yeah. Correct. And I think most Michiganders, they really relate to the deposit law. So it's kind of part of our identity, and it's a very, very popular law. So when anybody sees that being challenged, they're gonna speak out.
Right.
Those that want it and those that don't want it, for that matter.
Well, the legislation proposed, I think, by a legislator from Ann Arbor wants to expand to include containers that are not currently included in the deposit law. And then there are others who are clamoring for maybe the best thing to do down the road is get regional recycling centers and eliminate the deposit law altogether. What should people listening to this show be thinking about and looking at, Tom?
Michigan does have a relatively low solid waste recycling rate. We need to do something. That being said, I don't think starting or looking at the most successful piece of legislation in Michigan's history is the way to go. We have a 97% approval rating of the current deposit law. And people ask, well, why is it so popular? Well, there's three primary reasons why the deposit law is very popular. One is the dime deposit is a huge incentive for the consumer to return the container. Second is the return to retail has proven over time to be, very convenient and successful and accepted form of behavior for our citizens. Along those lines, industry has improved the process of over the last 35 years with the deposit law. When I talk industry, I talk retailers, I talk bottlers, distributors, and I talk recyclers to make it the most efficiently run deposit system in the country. So when you add those two things together and all the jobs that it creates, between retailers, bottlers, distributors, and recyclers, there's thousands of jobs that have been created by the deposit law in Michigan. And last but not least, it creates a very high quality stream of material. And when you get into more single-stream type operations, you'll have cross-contamination. Aluminum gets mixed with plastic, glass gets mixed with plastic and aluminum and other recyclables. So from an industry standpoint, deposits have created a very high-valued stream of material that, at the end of the day, I've talked about my four E's before, E's. Education, ease, efficient, and economically viable markets. The deposit law captures all that. So that's kind of like the defense of the current system.
My guest is Tom Emmerich. He's president of Shupan Recycling. Well, Tom, just from a consumer perspective, I mean, all the things that you said about the success of the bill. I mean, when I go to my local stores, I take my returnables back. They go into the machines, and then a lot of them probably end up at Shoe Pan Recycling in bundles. It's very convenient for me. Everything we've learned on this program is convenience, convenience, convenience. If you go to regional redemption centers, for example, and if store owners have the ability to opt out of taking returnables, I mean, it seems to me you lose a convenience factor there.
Well, I think that's a real challenge for them, no doubt, for us as citizens. One thing I do have to say is Shoe Pan Recycling, we are a service provider. All right. At the end of the day, somebody comes to our company and says, hey, we have this problem. Can you help us with it? And that's what we did with the deposit law. You know, the bottlers and distributors came to us, and we've helped them solve the problem. If the state of Michigan wants to move away from return to retail, while I may not necessarily agree that's the best solution, we're certainly want to participate, and we will be participating in the effort to explore other concepts. One of those is redemption-type system. One thing I do find very interesting is when this subject came up a couple of weeks ago at the legislature, well, when the DEQ report actually became somewhat public, Channel 6 in Lansing, WLNS, ran a poll of citizens. If there were redemption centers, would you continue to recycle your bottles and cans? And overwhelmingly, I think it was over 80% of the respondents said they would not. They would discontinue. So that is a concern that if you want to go down the redemption center road, that we as an industry need to get together and figure out how we got to keep convenience there.
Well, again, putting it in a personal perspective, I mean, I take all of my non-deposits to the Michigan State University Recycling Center. The thought of them taking my deposits along with me, assuming they had machines there in order to do that, I mean, I'd probably continue to do that, but am I going to encounter long lines in these redemption centers with the people that I don't encounter now in my local retail outlet?
Likely. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I would like to put a plug in for that Michigan State Recycling Center because it's awesome. I go there once every week or every other week.
And I would agree with you.
but yeah, those are the things that when you try to change behavior, too, there's going to be a huge learning curve if you try to step away from return to retail and into redemption centers or something different. So I would agree that you will do the right thing, but what's right for you may not necessarily be right for somebody else. And there are other states that have shown that when you move away from a deposit, I think it was Delaware, repealed their bottle law with the idea that curbside recycling would pick up and drop-off centers would pick up, and they have not seen that happen.
They just haven't seen it happen. Again, I go back to, I'm just trying to think through this thing a little bit, but even from the retailer perspective, if I'm making it convenient for my customers to come to my store and drop off their deposit bottles, et cetera, I mean, why would I discontinue that if I might lose customers because of that? Because, again, it's a convenience factor.
You know, there's no doubt that the retailers have some concerns about, they'll say people are bringing garbage into the stores, and the larger retailers have really embraced the law, I believe, over the years and done a very, very nice job of making it even more convenient and cleaner. You know, the third-party pickup program that's run by a company that Shoe Pan and Tom in North America own together, it's called UBCR LLC, started in 1998. To go into the large retailers, we cleaned up a lot of that. Okay, it's still not perfect for retailers. I understand that, especially the smaller ones.
You know, they
don't have a lot of room in their back rooms, and I do. I totally get where they're coming from on this. You're probably better off to talk to them as to what their exact issues are. The flip side of that is the system still works very, very well. There is no piece of legislation that is foolproof, that doesn't have some challenges to it. And I look at the Michigan deposit law and I say, well, 97% of the bottles and cans are returned and recycled. That's a pretty good success rate.
Okay, so Tom, not to put you on the spot here, but okay, so we've got these different options that are floating around out there. Right now they're just recommendations, although there is some legislation that's being introduced. I mean, what can the voter, what can the listener do? You're suggesting they get informed, but I mean, where do they get the information that they need to know to support appropriate decisions?
First thing they need to do is pay attention. Whenever new legislation is or controversial or important legislation is introduced, it shows up in your local newspapers, it shows up on the web, it shows up on the news stations. So they need to pay attention. And then I think you'll stay in contact with your legislators and do some of your own research. There's plenty of information out there on deposit systems or on recycling efforts and MRFs. And, you know, so there's a lot they can do and find on their own just by surfing the web. Stay in contact with their local government. And please pay attention to what's going on in the news because it does matter.
You know, and again, let me editorialize here if I may, but what's wrong with keeping the 10-cent deposit law that we have and still do a lot of the other things that are in the DEQ report, expand education, get better systems for tracking and monitoring how much we recycle. All the other areas seem to be things that we ought to be doing. Why do we have to sacrifice a good law in the process?
Well, you won't get an argument from me on that, but I will say that you know, the DEQ's 6 points of light, I guess I'll call it. you know, there's some really good stuff there, and I think they've done a really nice job in bringing industry together and the stakeholders together. And stakeholders are made up not just deposit stakeholders. It's your solid waste recyclers, it's your solid waste haulers, it's your MRF, your municipal MRFs, and pretty much anybody that has a stake in increasing Michigan's solid waste recycling rate. And I think they've done a great job in bringing these folks together. And there's another meeting coming up in October where we as a group are going to sit down and say, okay, what's the next step? What can we as industry, can we as citizens do together to increase Michigan's rate? And at the end of the day, that's what we all want. Personally, I'll go back to, I don't think messing with the state's most successful piece of recycling legislation is a place to start. And messing with that means anything different than what we're doing today. So I'm in total support of what exists today. You asked me earlier about bottle bill expansion. I don't have a position on that. I'll let the legislators figure out how they want to handle that. We do have a system that's in place that could potentially handle it with some challenges. At the end of the day, I'd still like to see industry kind of get together and try to solve this issue.
Well, we all agree recycling is a good thing. Michigan needs to do a better job of recycling, but let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Well said.
I've been talking with Tom Emmerich. He is the president of our good friends at Shoepan Recycling. Tom, always great to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
MLive Media Group is a Greening of the Great Lakes partner. To read Kirk's blog and to hear our show archives, please visit mlive.com/environment.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. You know, we live in a time where people just don't join things anymore. So why are so many Spartans joining the MSU Alumni Association? Well, perhaps it's our world-class alumni enrichment team, constantly stretching Spartan minds and supercharging Spartan careers. Or perhaps it's our Spartan pipeline, which connects you to trusted friends wherever your adventures may take you. The MSU Alumni Association is dedicated to adding Spartan value to your Spartan life. Whatever it is that may be keeping you up at night, we can connect you with a fellow Spartan who can help. We truly live in a world where who you know is just as important as what you know. And joining the MSU Alumni Association can help you build the relationships you need for success on the job and in every corner of your Spartan life. That's why more and more Spartans are joining the MSU Alumni Association. Activate your membership right now at alumni.msu.edu.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
MSU Today is online at SpartanPodcast.com. Here's Russ White.
Here are Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with MSU's Vice President for Research, Stephen Hsu. Their conversation begins with Simon and Hollis asking Hsu why it's important for universities like MSU to conduct research.
I think it's a really fair question for taxpayers and parents who are paying tuition to ask that question because, you know, research is very specialized these days and the average person just has trouble understanding what it's all about. The way I like to explain it is that the research we do today is what is going to make the future awesome for our kids. And one example I like to give is that when I was a kid growing up, I used to watch Star Trek, the original Star Trek with Kirk and Spock. And I remember that communicator that they used. I thought, wow, that's awesome. I bet my whole life I'm never going to – by the time I'm done, we're still not going to have something that cool. And right now on the table, I've got in front of me an iPhone, which is actually cooler, if you think about it, than what Kirk and Spock had. And how is it that I have that? If you ask an engineer at Apple or Samsung who builds one of these things, most people might think the innovation for this device actually comes from them. But if you ask one of those engineers, they'll probably point to their professor or to research done at a university as being really the key innovation that led to this device. You've got a microwave antenna in there that's tiny. You've got microchips. You've got more memory than supercomputers used to have when I was a kid in your phone. All those things are consequences of research that was done 20, 30 years ago at universities. And so if we want our future to be as amazing to our kids as today is to would have been to me when I was 10, we've got to continue investing in that research.
So I sit here next to you. I think I have three Apple products in my possession right now.
You've got the trifecta.
You hit people, and I think that's an important thing, that we live in a world of technology right now, but people are what motivate and push us forward. And in that process, you're not much different than a Tom Izzo or a Mark D'Antonio in that you have to get out into the marketplace and find the best of the best and recruit and offer packages very much like a coach would with scholarships and the like in order to entice them to come to the greatest place in America right here at Michigan State University. And I would guess that you maybe look at it a little bit like recruiting a student athlete.
You know, I think everybody in society understands and loves sports. And business people really like sports because they're competing every day in their businesses the same way that teams and coaches are competing. Universities also compete. So when we're trying to recruit a really good researcher, a really good graduate student, a really good postdoc, all of those people have choices the same way that a star football player, when they graduate from college, they have choices as well. And so we have to compete every day. We compete on the basis of salary, research package, graduate stipend. There's actually even more flexibility in the way we compete relative to what the NCAA allows. You're not allowed to double the scholarship offer to some student just because they've got a great jump shot, whereas we actually can. And when we're competing for that really great computer science grad student, MIT might offer them significantly more stipend money than we do, and we might lose that kid. So it's a battle every day, and it's really driven by resources.
When we have concerts in the Breslin Center or the like, many of the performers will have specific needs that they want to have in their locker room. Might be all red jelly beans or the like. What are some of the values that an individual who is engaged heavily in research and you want to get 110%, as they say, out of them when they're in the process? What are some of the variables that might come into play? Some of them, maybe there's some that are way out there.
The thing that's really refreshing about all this is that most people who go into research, they're idealistic people. The thing they really want from you, from me, or from Luana is the resources to be great. They're generally not, salary is a kind of way of keeping score, but they're not as obsessed with salary as ordinary people are, actually. What they really want is the resources to hire a great team, to build a great lab, and really to make the breakthroughs that will impact society.
And the collaboration opportunities that you have in the state of Michigan, we look at it as competition with a variety of different universities, but also private practice that's engaged in research in this state. I have to think that becomes a benefit as you reach out and look for individuals to be part of our program.
Absolutely. This state has a very deep history in manufacturing, advanced manufacturing, the auto industry. I think those are all things which going forward are going to be more and more important to the American economy. We're currently recruiting a guy who is an expert in human-machine interactions, the way that people relate to machines. And that's going to become incredibly important as the auto companies change the cockpit. Everybody wants to use their internet-connected devices in their car. There are going to be safety features where the car senses threats and makes the driver aware of them. All of those things have to be integrated and integrated with an eye toward human psychology and human attention spans. And so that's a direction I think that's really promising for us.
Is Michigan State, in your role, engaged in startup businesses trying to create new business, not only in the state of Michigan, hopefully in the state of Michigan, but others where you get entrepreneurs that are stepping forward and trying to create new solutions to the research?
You know, there are sort of two aspects of this. One is the technologies that our researchers here develop, getting them to the market in an efficient way, helping those people. A lot of those people are sort of propeller heads. They're not thinking about the marketplace. They're thinking only about what's going on in their lab. Helping them figure out what has commercial prospects and what, you know, really you're going to have to wait another 20 years to see any commercial development of. That's an important part of it. But aside from the technologies, we want to help students here who have business ideas. And they may not be technology driven. They may just be, hey, I think there's a better way to do this. Or I think people really buy this type of service or this type of product. And we want to enable those students so they understand, these are young kids, so they understand that if they really can execute on their idea, they could actually grow something very small into a huge business, which impacts the world.
Well, I think as you look at your background, it ranges from physics into economics, and to have that mix and to have that blend is unique. And I applaud President Simon for having that vision, because you do have to have the full cycle, I believe. It can't just be what's done in the laboratory, but it's taking that and making this a better world because of the research that happens on our campus.
You know, universities are very special places because they're repositories of creative people, highly trained people, highly intelligent people, and they have a culture that encourages experimentation, new ideas. And so it's not a surprise that if you really do a serious study of any technology, any product that's innovative, and you trace it back, you'll often find that the origin hits some university.
And I think that's why it's so hard for us in an age of accountability to be able to argue for this essentially inefficient space of ideas that have produced, a company or two companies in your case that have had economic impact and are very valuable from a technological perspective for the country. And at the same time, if you were just sort of measured in a very narrow way, you probably wouldn't have been very successful.
it takes a certain perspective to realize that you need to invest in risky endeavors and endeavors that you can't immediately see where they're going to lead. And that's what we have to do, because nobody can predict what is going to happen 30 years from now. But it's the activities today that are happening at MSU that are going to impact that future 30 years from now. One group that sort of appreciates this at a slightly smaller time scale is venture capitalists. Venture capitalists are very used to the idea that they're going to invest in 10 companies. Each of those 10 companies is led by an extremely smart, energetic team of people. But 8 out of 10 of them are going to fail. Only maybe 2 out of 10 are going to succeed. And they're used to that. They plan for that. So if you walk into a lab on campus and you say, well, gosh, I have no idea whether what this particular professor's work is going to lead to, But much of the work won't lead to anything, but that's the way it has to be. It has to be just actually a risky thing where some of it's going to fail and some of it's going to succeed.
So part of what Vice President of Research do is sort of be the internal venture capitalist with enough sort of sense of being able to sort of assess the landscape, not simply internally, but against our competition, because there's competition around the world for us, and make those essentially venture capital bets.
That's exactly how I view my job. And we have limited resources. You know, we're in a situation where students are strapped to make their student loan payments and pay tuition. The state has budget problems. So we have limited resources, and we have to allocate them in the best possible way. I think Mark has the same situation where he's got to figure out, well, where does that marginal dollar, that's what economists call it, the extra dollar, if you had one extra dollar, where would you put it? Are you going to put it in the arena? Are you going to increase some coach's salary? Are you going to, buy some more jelly beans for the locker room? that's what every leader in every organization has to do.
I have to think one of your bigger challenges is the balance of optimism and pessimism and how you handle each situation that comes before you. Are you going to engage it in an optimistic or pessimistic approach? Is that a fair assessment?
It's very fair, because first of all, if you're too pessimistic, you're never going to be in the business of investing in research and future companies and things like that. You'll never do it. You've got to have some optimistic streak in you. But you have to be hard-headed, because the people who are too optimistic, they're just going to blow their resources on the wrong things. Mm-hmm. And so you have to know when to cut it off. That is the hardest thing for any venture investor or even CEO of a company, is when to say, hey, we tried it it didn't work, we're going to have to cut that off. Mm-hmm. And that is extremely hard.
That was MSU's Vice President for Research, Stephen Hsu, talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear an extended version of their conversation, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
The program is MSU Today. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association with some observations from the Spartan life. We love our comfort zones. Even an uncomfortable status quo is preferable to the unknown. But things change. We outgrow a job, or the job outgrows us. Our relationship ends. A health crisis appears. Or the sting of an unhappy current reality becomes so great that we are forced to step outside of our self-imposed boundaries. This is one of life's great ironies. We often fight to stay inside the box when the very thing we need to fuel our future lies on the outside. This week, make a list of the things that are keeping you inside your comfort zone. How many of them are self-imposed? Every single one. The next chapter of your life's adventure will be written with or without your direct involvement. Maybe it's time to imagine what that chapter might be if your uncomfortable comfort zone didn't exist. As I was researching this week's message, I discovered this anonymous poem, which I've customized just for you. I hope it gets you thinking about those self-imposed limitations and the opportunities that lie beyond them. I used to have a comfort zone where I knew I wouldn't fail. The same four walls and busy work were really more like jail. I longed so much to do the things I'd never done before, but stayed inside my comfort zone and paced the same old floor. I didn't want to build the traits successful people share. I watched my friends advance and thrive, pretending not to care. I claimed to be so busy with the things inside the zone, but deep inside, I longed for something special of my own. I couldn't let my life go by just watching others grow. I held my breath, I stepped outside, and let the changes flow. I took a step, and with new strength I'd never felt before, I kissed my comfort zone goodbye and closed and locked the door. If you're in a comfort zone, afraid to venture out, remember that our heroes were at one time filled with doubt. A step or two and words of praise can make your dreams come true. Reach for your future with a smile. Happiness is there for you. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans Helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.